pop the. We might say the meanest things. Pop the. Sometimes we're not much company. There's no rearranging. Our writing remains the same. We remain the same. And as far as we're concerned, pop the. You belong to us. Pop the.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to episode 22 of the Pop Dose Podcast. I'm Dave Lifton, and let's get this out of the way now. We didn't have an episode in October because I screwed up.
Lift and fail.
Yes, we had a really good conversation with our Pop Dose colleague, Brian Boone, about his excellent book, I Love Rock and Roll, Except When I Hate It, and there wound up being a technical problem that deleted the last half hour of my audio. So I'd like to publicly apologize to Brian for that, but I won't. And although I will say that hopefully we won't have a repeat of it this time around, and by we, of course, I'm referring to my co-hosts, Jeff Giles and Jason Hare. Gentlemen.
Oh, hello. Good morning. How are you?
We're joined by Jason's aunt.
Is this the one that got mad at me when I made the mom joke on Facebook?
Jeff, you got a little schmutz on your face. You should really, it looks like semen.
Don't lick your finger and touch me.
No. Actually, when I said that last one, I sounded like Adam Sandler.
Right.
You know, Dave, you did fuck up the last episode, but in all fairness, I fucked up an episode last year sometime when we had Wardlaw on the show.
Yes.
So I guess the moral is just let's not have guests on.
Or at least not Pop Dose guests.
That's right. I think it's like some kind of subconscious self-sabotage or something.
It's the podcast curse.
The podcast curse.
The energy created by too many pop dosers in one podcast causes instant failure.
It's a shame, actually, because the episode with Brian was great, whereas the episode with Wardlaw was just kind of shitty anyway, so it didn't really matter.
Well, it's Wardlaw.
Not right. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, the smell of Taco Bell wafted through the computers.
That was probably what screwed it up on my end.
But I felt really bad for Brian.
Yeah.
Taking time out of his book tour to talk to us, and we fucked it up.
Lay it on him, Jeff.
Yep.
All that time he took? He took all that time out of his day. He's a very busy man. The least you could do is get your software in order.
Get the schmutz off your software.
Right. Well, I saw a concert last night.
Really? Who'd you see?
Acoustic 80s?
I saw the Bacon Brothers.
Why would you go see the Bacon Brothers?
My mom got tickets. They were playing in our hometown. And our hometown, it's so interesting. There's like this, basically like this elementary school auditorium, which has turned into like a concert venue, mainly for like folk artists, WFUV friendly artists, I'll say, for those of you in New York who listen to WFUV. You'll know what I mean. Who's played there? Like Joan Osborne plays there, Dar Williams plays there, and the Bacon Brothers play there. Indigo Girls played there recently, and we went, and when my mom signed up to be a member to get the tickets, she, for some reason, bought Bacon Brothers tickets as well. And you know,
I'm unhappy that we're living in a world where the Indigo Girls are on the same tour circuit as the Bacon Brothers.
Well, you know, it's funny, Jeff. I thought they were going to be just kind of eh, and I was completely right.
Yeah, I bought their first record, the one with the weird title, For Ahsoka or whatever.
Yeah, something like that.
It was okay.
Yeah, they were all quite competent.
Yes.
But just nothing very interesting. And watching Kevin Bacon perform, like, if you didn't know who he was, you'd think he was just some guy kind of strung out on heroin.
Yeah.
Like, he has the most awkward stage presence.
Really? I would have thought if nothing else, there would be that element of star charisma with him.
Well, I don't know. I mean, he definitely was the most interesting out of the group. Oh, no, that's not true. Because the bassist...
Johnny Lightfoot?
Was this... The bassist was this guy who looked... He was the physical embodiment of the voice I opened the podcast up with. He was like a little overweight, balding, hook nose, looked like
Bob Lefsetz?
He didn't look that far from left. I'll have to see if I can get a picture.
You anti-Semite bastard.
He was a very good bassist, but it was like, wow. Like, I could take my eyes off this guy all night. He was kind of dancing like he had a load in his pants, and like he was doing, like he couldn't wait to get home and like just finish his taxes.
Who has better stage presence, Kevin Bacon or Jack Wagner?
I think Jack Wagner.
Wow.
I think Jack Wagner. I think.
Did they do Footloose?
They didn't fucking do Footloose. They perform Footloose when they play.
Do they?
They do.
I was only asking because that silly reboot just came out, and
they do play it sometimes. But last night they didn't. There, I would say there were probably three songs where I was like, "Now those were good songs." The rest of them, I was just kind of like, "All right."
That's how I felt about their first record. Who do you think would win in an arm wrestling match, Kevin Bacon or Kenny Loggins?
Kenny Loggins.
Wow.
Kenny Loggins. Kevin Bacon is like, he's like a toothpick.
So is Kenny Loggins.
I think Kenny Loggins. Well, you know what? I may be thinking of like 80s Kenny Loggins. Are we talking like 2011 Kenny Loggins?
Yeah, this afternoon. If we got them in the same room. Yeah.
This afternoon. I think we could make that happen, actually.
Scrawny Kevin Bacon or plastic face creepy Kenny Loggins?
I'm still going to put my money on Kenny.
All right.
Is it because he's not carrying all that excess weight from all those enemas?
I thought you were going to make a Messina joke.
wait. So who got enemas?
No, Kenny Loggins, because he's...
Remember?
Was that part of the unimaginable life?
Yes. That was how he met his second wife. She was his...
Oh, that's right.
His ass therapist.
I know about that from you guys.
I forgot.
How could you not? Because it's at the point that I can't even hear Kenny Loggins' name without thinking of
his ass.
Wow. Without thinking of his ass. Nice. Oh, man. Who would win? Who would win Kenny in an arm wrestling match? Kenny Loggins or Richard Marks?
Richard Marks.
Yeah, damn straight.
Yeah. He's got youth on his side.
That's true.
Those pictures, I think you probably saw those stories that were in the news when the Footloose remake came out, and they some idiot asked Kenny Loggins to comment on the new soundtrack.
No, what happened?
He said that, and I think this is very funny, because if you know anything about Kenny Loggins' music from the 80s, particularly, you know, from Footloose on, it was very, 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 very produced, very synthesized. Not natural sounding in any way, shape, or form. And his comment was that it sounded too produced. That you know, that they used too much auto-tune or whatever. That they just didn't stand back and let the music breathe.
Well, I can understand that to a certain extent.
Can you? Listen to Footloose. Listen to I'm All Right.
Well, I think there's a difference between that kind of vocal and like an auto-tuned vocal.
But those are both...
Yes,
everything he did
in production. Sure.
Yeah, all studio creations. Anyway, there was a picture. Because I think they asked him this question on the red carpet someplace. So there was a picture of him, a very recent picture of him attached to the story. And it made me very sad.
Yeah, he looked like not quite all there, right?
He looked like not quite all there. And he's kind of getting the Paul Simon hair.
Oh.
It looks like it maybe is about to just kind of slide off his head in shame.
Ooh. Oh, yeah. In shame? Is that what you said? In shame?
Yes.
Nice.
And his face looks a little fucked up.
Yeah. I told you when I saw him in concert, it was like he didn't look all quite there, and it was a little sad.
He's had like, some tough years, man.
At least if you... Well, so did Lionel Richie, and Lionel Richie still looks like he's all there. And he's had a lot of face work done, too.
Who do you think makes more publishing money, Lionel Richie or Kenny Loggins?
Lionel Richie.
Yeah, see? So there you go. He can afford better middle-aged facial care.
I know you sent something recently to me, Jeff, about Lionel Richie coming out with a country album.
Yes, indeed.
Sounds awful. Sounds like it's going to be terrible.
I didn't even read it. I just saw Richie country record.
We have a problem when Lionel Richie is looking at Darius Rucker's career and going, I want that.
Now, speaking of Darius Rucker, did you guys see Jeff Vrabel make the announcement? And I don't know if he was kidding or not. I hope he was.
I think he was kidding.
I sort of hope he wasn't, but...
I saw what it was, and I think it was kind of like in response to something. It was a joke about something else. And if you say what it was, I'll probably remember what it was in response to.
Wasn't it Darius Rucker doing an evening of Sinatra songs or something like that?
Yeah, I think it was just a reference to... Scott Weiland.
Oh.
I think he was just like make like the next 90s washed up guy to make a joke about to make an album of Christmas songs.
Scott Weiland.
I'm looking forward to listening to that album.
I got through a few songs.
And?
Well, you know, we heard a song 3 years ago, probably, yeah. Right? And when it starts, you're like, oh, it's Weiland crooning. I didn't expect this. But I got to the third or fourth song, and the seams started to show. I mean, he's not a crooner. And after a while, it started to sound to me like he was almost doing a parody of that type of vocal.
Interesting.
We'll get into it. We'll get into it soon. Melamus right. Just around the corner.
That's right. True.
We'll have to decide whether to cover that one first or the Joey McIntyre Christmas album first.
Oh, that's yes. Right.
Or the John Tesh big band one.
Yes, John Tesh. Tesh puts a big band to sleep.
we've kind of got an embarrassment of riches this year. We're
absolutely. We're
almost done.
We are, and we've hardly broken a sweat.
Unbelievable.
That's because it started in like July.
Yeah, we started in August.
Yeah, but it also speaks to just the sheer number of albums and songs that we've had to choose from.
And yeah. Also the growth of Melamus in general, that like everybody is sending you, anytime there's any news about a Christmas album somewhere, people are sending you stuff. Hell, I sent you one. I don't know if you've done that one yet. I'm not telling you. I sent this to Jeff. He's gonna hasn't sprung it on you. But when I saw it, Jason, I specifically thought of you.
I think I did pass that along.
It's not the Richard Marx Christmas EP, is it?
No.
You sent that to me, and you said we weren't allowed to cover it.
Yeah, I listened to it finally. It's a solid 3-star release the entire way through. It's not bad. It's not good.
No, Jeff. By the way, that was the site where I found that is where I found the album that I just sent you for Yermageddon.
You fucker!
Did you wind up listening to that?
No, I haven't listened to it yet.
Still haven't listened to it yet. Okay.
I'm sure it's going to be terrible. We've been having some fun with the Yermageddon.
Yeah, it was
so happy. I made you listen to Lisa Welchel.
Yeah,
that was great.
Jason, have you heard this? Did you hear any of this?
The album itself?
Yeah.
No, I didn't. I was with Jeff when we found it. We found it during a Melamus chat.
Oh yeah, I think he said that he did that, but yeah, I didn't know.
I read your review.
I thought I had posted because I had posted
the video. Yeah, I listened to that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't see it. I think I was reading it on my RSS reader or something, so I didn't get to actually check it out.
The video is one of those that it's actually a video of somebody putting the needle on the record and
with the album cover, right?
Yeah, it's got like a room mic recording the song. So yeah, it sounds even worse.
It's not the actual video of the song.
It's not an actual produced video.
Right. It's more like this is an example of what the hell within. was I right that it was just like kind of decent mid-80s pop?
Yeah, she just has a very she had no business singing.
Right. Where did you come from, baby? So what we've decided to do is have another chart attack. And this week we have chosen the Billboard Top 10 from November 26th, 1983. And the number 10 song of that week, PYT, Pretty Young Thing, Michael Jackson.
Love this song.
Yeah.
Love this song.
How much clearer an example can you make of you know, the difference between now and then? And just kind of the richness of that musical era, than to point out that this was wasn't it the sixth single?
It was the sixth, and it was the lowest charting, I believe. Wasn't it the lowest charting?
Well, it peaked right here at number 10.
Number 10?
Yeah.
I couldn't believe that. I was like, this song should have been so much higher.
Six deep, and this is what you come out with.
Yeah. And Thriller hadn't even been released yet, the single.
It had?
Thriller was the last single.
Really?
Thriller was the last one.
Huh. No.
Released in,
really?
Yes, released in fucking January.
That's right. No, yeah, because wow. I remember watching the making of the video at a friend's New Year's party.
This song always trips me up in karaoke, because you start to sing it, and it's like, oh yeah, I could totally sing this, and then suddenly it gets into some range where you just can't sing it, like the chorus. It's like, yeah. Oh, way too high. I made a big mistake.
Yeah. That's pretty much everything with me in karaoke.
But what a fantastic song.
Yeah. You know, I look at the three records he did in the 80s, the Quincy Jones records, as like a progressive toughening of his sound. You know, each album got a little bit heavier. You know, Off the Wall is really light. But when I listen to PYT, I think that could have come from Off the Wall.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Because it's really, really bouncy. And it's got that, you know, that funky guitar line in there that just, like, opens up a lot of space in the same way that Rock With You did.
Yeah, I would say that if you're going to compare the three Quincy Jones albums, you know, like Thriller and Off the Wall are quite similar. Just in the way that, I mean, Bad sounds completely different.
Yeah.
Completely different from those two. Yeah. Interesting though. This wasn't written by Rod Temperton.
No, it was written by James Ingram.
Yeah. It doesn't sound like a Rod Temperton song though.
No.
But yeah. James Ingram, right? With Quincy Jones, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what happened was originally it was written, I think it was a whole, it started off as a whole different song.
It was a different song, right, that Michael Jackson wrote.
With Greg Fillinganes.
That's right.
And Quincy just liked the title.
Right.
So he took it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, Michael, we're totally going to go with this. We just want to make a few changes.
Thankfully, PYT didn't enter the lexicon.
PYT was like, could have been like the shoddy of the... Ugh. Early 1980s. I hate that word so much.
Me too.
I love, and this is going to be something of a recurring motif on today's chart. I love that Michael's sisters do the background vocals on this song.
Yep.
They are the PYTs.
That's right.
Yep.
That's right. Gross.
It is gross. And this will come up again on the chart.
He was probably too awkward to ask anybody else to do it.
excuse me. The best part of the song, I think, is the vocoder.
Yeah, I agree. I'll go with that.
And I looked it up, and it's Michael Boddicker.
The guy who used to pitch relief for the Orioles?
I don't think so. Although, he's done enough. If you look him up, he's got a discography as long as Michael Parr.
I think the best part of the song is Michael awkwardly speaking in the beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Doesn't really know what he's saying. Michael, sounds sexy.
James Ingram may have written that for him, too.
Number 9, Crumbling Down by John Cougar Menstrual Cramp. What? I've never heard that joke.
Nope.
It's been a while.
Oh, wow.
It's been a while.
Yeah.
This was the first Mellencamp song.
No, it wasn't.
It's the first one that wasn't Johnny Cougar.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
This was the first John Mellencamp song. This was his coming out party as an adult.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of interesting that this was the first single off of Uh-Huh.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you had Pink Houses also on that album, which is I think is obviously a far superior song.
Pink Houses is the one that I think of when I think of Uh-Huh.
Right, and Authority Song also.
Oh, yeah, Authority Song is great.
Pink Houses is the one I think of when I'm with your mother.
Oh, God. I thought that was Sugar Walls. Pink Houses with Sugar Walls?
Pink.
That's gross.
Sorry. Keep going.
I'm hanging up. If you're gonna make mom jokes, you know, at least make them funny.
Oh, come on.
Yeah, but I was wondering if like they chose this as the first single because it was a little bit tougher. It was kind of like in that Hurt So Good type vein. It was more like a Johnny Cougar song than a John what we would later know it to be a John Cougar Mellencamp song.
Don't you think Authority song out Cougars this one?
Oh yeah, I think this. I think this is actually a fairly weak song. It's one of those things that you kind of see with a lot of Mellencamp songs, where they sound great. It's got a real tough, no frills kind of Stonesy vibe to it.
Uh huh. And there's nothing there.
There's nothing there in the lyrics, but you could see that he was starting to hit his stride. But I mean, it still works. It's in its way because I think the music is so good.
We should pour one out here for the song's co-writer, Mellencamp's pal, George Greene.
Oh, right, yeah, he did die.
He died just in August, and they wrote a few songs together. Hurt So Good, and I Saw You First.
Wow. Oh, I love that song.
Yeah, it's the last really good Mellencamp song.
I don't know. I mean, I remember this one, but I don't remember even thinking much about it at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I liked the hits on American Fool.
I don't know if this will make any sense, but in my mind, as a 9-year-old, I always put this in the same category as Peter Wolf's Lights Out, a song that's pretty much all chorus, that there's just it doesn't go anywhere, it doesn't really do anything, it just repeats a lot of lines.
Yeah, I definitely think that. Yeah, there's another song on here that I think when we talk about it that we'll get to soon that I think is also all chorus and no verse.
I wish we were talking about Authority song, because that's a song that I could listen to every day.
I would say probably of the majority of Mellencamp singles, this is the one I know the least. Like, this is the one that I've had the least familiarity with.
Even counting the farm aid type stuff he was doing with Scarecrow?
I don't know.
He really started to piss me off toward the late 80s. It seemed like every single was about him growing up in a small town, and I just couldn't listen anymore.
Yeah, Check It Out, and all the Lonesome Jubilee stuff.
I'm talking about like all of his like top 10 singles, I guess.
Yeah,
even then you're talking about Small Town and ROCK in the USA.
I know all those way better than I do Crumbling Down.
I don't think Crumbling Down is his worst.
I didn't say it was his worst.
I think it's the worst of the big hits he had in the 80s.
Really?
Yeah.
All right.
I like the Lonesome Jubilee songs.
Because I think on a song like Pink Houses, he's reaching for something that he really has no business reaching for. You know, when Mellencamp tried to make statements, I think he generally didn't do very well.
Yeah, but I think he had to work really hard at it to do that. And he was just good enough, I think, to he didn't come quite close to making the statement as good as...
Say it.
Bruce. but I think he kind of did it in his in a different way. I don't think that what he got was the human quality, the compassionate quality.
No, because the seams always showed. You could tell that he was trying.
Number 8, Heart and Soul, Huey Lewis and the News.
Yay!
Jason, have you ever covered this?
No. No, the only Huey Lewis song I think we've covered is Hip to Be Square. But I like Heart and Soul. It's a cover.
I know.
I had no idea.
It's an Exile cover.
Has anybody heard the original?
No.
No.
In fact, this was a double cover because it was done by Exile and the Busboys before Huey Lewis and the News did it.
The Busboys one was before Huey Lewis?
I think so. I love that this was written by the same guys who wrote Kiss You All Over and Mickey.
And Stumbling In for Suzy Quatro and Ballroom Blitz.
Oh, yeah, they wrote a ton of stuff, but I just mean...
Oh, Mike Chapman.
Chapman and
he wrote
Chin.
Another song on here.
Yeah. Yep, yeah, that's right.
Chapman and Chin had all kinds of hits, but to go from Kiss You All Over to Mickey to Heart and Soul, I think is... I try not to miss the 80s too much, but to read stuff like that.
Do you guys like Heart and Soul?
It's okay. It's not my favorite song from sports.
Yeah, me neither, but I like it.
You know, earlier this year we got into, Jeff and I and some of our other friends, Jason, I don't think you were there, had one of our Friday night debates about Huey Lewis. And I think Jeff and I just wanted to get into an argument.
What?
Because, like...
That doesn't sound like us at all.
I know. Because, you know, like, I was taking, like, this real Huey Lewis was sucks approach. You know, I was kind of ragging on this, and, like, everybody kind of jumped down my throat. You know, and I had this album. You know, everybody did.
Everybody had this album.
Yeah, exactly. But... You know, I think there was enough talent in that group to make me wish that they had been better. I also think it was because Born in the USA came out the next year. And if you look at how those bands were perceived as being similar.
Blue-collar rockers.
Blue-collar, bar band, saxophone.
Right. Well, they were a bar band. I mean, they're one of those bands that they had no right to be as successful as they were, but that wasn't their fault. They were fine. They were a fine C+, B- level band.
Right.
And Sports is a pretty solid record.
Yeah, exactly.
Should it have sold a jillion copies? Probably not. And I think that they suffered for it.
No, I disagree.
But... Really? You think that it was...
I think these are all great pop songs.
But are they... I mean, can't you be a great pop song without dominating the charts for a year?
I guess.
I don't know. I just feel like they... I don't want to say that they were... They Peter principled out of the level where they belonged, but they were a bar band. They were a good bar band, and you know, today maybe they could be the type of band that would sell a lot of CDs at their gigs at the local pub or whatever.
Yeah,
I don't know.
No, this band would never be big now, but none of the bands on this chart would be big now. I don't know. I think they're all catchy, enjoyable pop tunes, and I think they're all... Most of them are different enough from each other in style.
It is a pretty eclectic record.
You know? I mean, yeah. Heart and Soul sounds nothing like I Want a New Drug, which sounds nothing like If This Is It.
Right. And then there's Walking on a Thin Line. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It's
I think they're all varied.
And I think that's one of the things that made, I think, Huey Lewis work, or at least this album work, is that there was diversity. They were a versatile band.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I think that,
or at least they were produced that way,
but they were.
They did a lot of outside material.
Well, yeah, but they could perform. They could play a bunch of a bunch of different types of songs. I don't think that's too much of a problem.
This tape didn't leave the deck in my dad's Camry until 4 came out. I think.
Nice.
I think we knew the words to every single song.
Wow. Isn't so. Hall & Oates.
Jeff's favorite song.
I love this song. I love
really?
It. I do. I used to lead off my live shows with this.
That's unfortunate.
Yeah.
Fuck you.
No, I'm just kidding.
Fuckers.
I'd love to hear you cover this. Actually, I think
give us the verse now.
No. Yeah. Absolutely not.
I'll play along on Melodica.
I think we did this at the Lake House, didn't we?
Either at the Lake House or when I came to visit you in New Hampshire, I think we kind of made our way through it.
This is another song that I could listen to every day. I didn't really appreciate it until I saw them on their acoustic tour, and they kind of...
Their acoustic soul? Acoustic power?
Acoustic power, yes. They kind of broke this song down. This is one of like a million songs from the 80s that I would have suspected does not really exist without synths, but, if you just strip it down to an acoustic guitar and a voice, it still works really well.
See, I don't know. This, I think, is one of my least favorite of their hits.
I think one of my least favorite is the other new track from the Greatest Hits record that this came from.
Which was?
Adult. Education.
Adult.
Oh, Adult. Yeah. That was shit. Song. But I think this is the song that I was saying that I think is all chorus and no verse. I don't think that the verse sticks in you. You remember the chorus.
Yeah, well, maybe it's just because I've heard it so many times. I think it's got some good lines in it. You know, for a bridge that isn't really a bridge, it's a pretty good bridge. He's just vamping, basically. You know, he does that whole why you want to go when you have to say...
Leading up back into the chorus, like it's kind of like it's not really a bridge. It's because the chords don't change. It's just like a breakdown, right?
Yeah, basically. And
is that what I'm thinking of?
Yes.
Okay.
And I think I read that was the spot where there was some kind of a fuck up or a breakdown in the programming
mm-hmm.
in the song, and that's why they had to do it that way. That our old buddy Jimmy Berlauer, came up with some kind of fix for it. But anyway, this is how powerful Hall & Oates were in 1983.
Well, up until 1986 or 85.
I think they started running out of gas with the next record, with the Big Bang Boom record.
Yeah.
But they were just, I mean, they could do no wrong in 83.
Yeah.
And this was just Daryl Hall being Daryl Hall, man. And he was really on a roll.
No, it was Daryl Hall trying to be Marvin Gaye.
Really?
Oh, yeah. You listen, those verses, he's trying to phrase exactly like Marvin Gaye on that, and using his kind of croon at the beginning, and then kind of like giving a little bit more grit as it heads up to the verse, to the chorus rather.
He was so good at that.
Yeah, but Marvin Gaye was better.
Of course Marvin Gaye was better. But Daryl Hall used to be so much better at singing than he is now.
Yeah, no, he was a great singer. I mean, I can't deny that.
See, you felt like the seams started to come apart at Big Bam Boom. I thought that the reason they really lost steam was because they split up for that period.
Mm-hmm.
And they couldn't reclaim it. Like, by the time they came back in 89, like, things had changed. And people weren't interested anymore. Either that or that album was just underwhelming.
But I think Big Bam Boom is pretty underwhelming, too. I've always hated Out of Touch.
Oh, yeah?
Always. And the production is so heavy on that record.
That is very true.
We are young.
Number 6, Love is a Battlefield, Pat Benatar.
Mm. Our second Chapman song.
Yeah.
And tied with We Belong for her biggest hit, topping out at number 5.
Does it tie with anything else for the most ridiculous video ever?
Yeah, it's funny. When I was watching the video for this, you know, she's supposed to be a teenager who gets kicked out of her house.
Yes.
Yeah.
She was 30 at the time.
Yeah.
And the guy...
Hey, shut up. I did very well playing a teenager when I was 30.
That is not the worst part of the video for me.
But the guy who plays her dad was only 5 years older than she was.
I'm a big fan of any video that involves a pimp fight.
A pimp fight that's solved by dancing?
Yeah.
That is the worst part. That dance there at the end where they're supposed to scare him off.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
So I think I mentioned this on another podcast, but I was watching A&E Private Sessions and Pat Benatar was on. Did I talk about this on another podcast?
I don't know. I don't listen to you.
Basically, I'm pretty sure she's doing everything in the original key, and she still sounds fantastic.
I'm sure she does, because, I mean, she was a trained singer, so she had...
A lot of people were trained singers that have lost it since then.
But I think the difference is that when you're a trained singer, one of the things you learn how to do is take care of your voice. You know, if you keep that up, you can do it.
You have to. Well, I don't know. You have to be You have to be obviously consistent about it. Like I always wonder, not always. Okay, always. I always wonder where Russell Hitchcock went. Like where the turning point where he was like, I just can't sing like this anymore. It was somewhere in the '90s, where he was just like, I don't have it anymore. I've lost it.
Who do you think would win in an arm wrestling match? Pat Benatar or Kenny Loggins?
Oh, Benatar.
Pat Benatar, for sure.
She was much tougher.
So, yeah, Love is a Battlefield. Don't know what else to say about this song other than that video. Sometimes it's better not to try and tell a story with the video.
It said here that this was credited as the first video to feature spoken word.
It's not a distinction that is a good one to have.
I don't even think it's one that even needs to be made. I just went over to SongFacts, which is one of my favorite sites, and there's a comment here. That pimp in the video played a huge role in my childhood. My dad wasn't around much, and that pimp played a major father role in my life. I wouldn't be here today if it weren't for that pimp. Plus, who else was dance fighting in videos at that time? Michael Jackson.
Michael Jackson.
Right? That's it.
Who would win in a dance fight? Michael Jackson or Pat Benatar?
Oh, Michael Jackson.
Michael Jackson. It
depends. Are you fighting with hairspray?
A Michael Jackson, Pat Benatar dance fight is Mike Tyson and Michael Spinks. 37 seconds or whatever.
Haven't seen the video in a long time, but don't they just kind of walk and shake?
There's definitely shimmying going on.
And then she walks off into the sunset, right? A sunrise, rather.
It's like Good Girl by Lisa Welchel.
It's just like it.
Number 5, Come On Feel the Noise by Quiet Riot. It was their follow-up to Come On Jason's Mom.
Oh.
If you're going to make a mom joke, it should really be funny and not pre-written like that one.
Oh, I hated this song when it was popular.
You know what I just have to say, what I love about the top 10 in like this era is that like a few weeks before this, Air Supply.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a few weeks after this, like, you know, Matthew Wilder. Like, you just have to love the fact that, like,
and look at the next song on the list.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
Here's the thing. Here's what I found out when I was doing research for this.
Wow.
Yeah, seriously.
First time ever. So Mental Health and Come On Feel the Noise represented the first time that a metal act had a number one album and a top five single. Okay.
Yeah.
So here's how the number one records broke down around this time. Mental Health displaced Synchronicity from the top spot.
Ooch.
It was knocked out of the top spot by Can't Slow Down.
Yes.
Which was knocked out of the top spot by Thriller.
Yes.
I mean, how's that for a four album run at number one?
It's beautiful.
It is.
Whether or not that Mental Health, and I don't know, I admittedly do not know much about Quiet Riot, and by much I mean anything, but like, regardless of how good that album is, I just love a world where you could have Quiet, Mental Health be a number one hit along with that kind of material.
Mm-hmm.
Or even have this song in the top 10.
Yeah, this song is really stupid. And
it's also a cover. It was a Slade song.
Right, a cover of a Slade song, but it was kind of... You could make the argument that it was kind of important, that it kind of paved the way for hair metal. I mean,
very much so, yeah. And it was this, and We're Not Going to Take It, and Round and Round, that were all kind of there. You know, to me, this song screams eighth grade for me. more than any of the songs on this list, I associate this song with that time. I'm back in junior high. I'm working on a classmate's on a group project for social studies in a classmate's house. You know, who had the poster of the album cover.
Oh, with the guy with the mask on his face?
Yeah. You know, that's where I am whenever I hear this song.
I just want to point out that while you were doing that, Mike Duquette's parents weren't even born yet.
band. I did not know much about them until I started looking into this and disappeared into one of those Wikipedia rabbit holes.
Yeah.
Very, very sad story. I mean, everybody knows that the vocalist died a few years ago.
Yeah, right.
But
cocaine.
Yeah. There have been 18 people in Quiet Riot.
And this was mostly after Spinal Tap came out and said right. 17 people have been in. Yeah, pretty much like everybody who was anybody. If you look at the axis of Deep Purple, Quiet Riot, Whitesnake, you know, like how many of those people all kind of wound
right,
up
Rudy
being...
Rudy Sarzo, yeah.
Yeah, they all wound up doing time at some point together.
But this song, I mean, if you want to look for examples of hit songs that really just kind of fuck things up for the bands that recorded them, I think this is a prime example because they just went directly, they did not pass go, they went right off the rails. The follow-up album to Metal Health came out in July of 84.
Huh.
Just months after this was a hit. And
right.
And it's still, I mean, I think it went platinum, but I think the vocalist, I don't know how to say his last name, DeBrow or DeBro.
I always thought it was DeBrow.
So, but he was gone by, in fact, no original members were left in the band by 89.
Huh.
Wow.
Very sad story for this band.
I didn't know any of this.
I remember when the follow-up record came out. I forget, was that the one that was called QR3?
I don't remember.
And MTV did one of those world premieres for it. And I remember that the video for the lead-off single, I think it was Mama, We're All Crazy Now. I think that was the lead-off single.
Really?
For the next record. I know they covered it on the next album. But it was one of those videos that had a little prologue and there was some narrative and the dude with the metal mask on his face was part of it. You know, he was supposed to be kind of like their
Eddie.
Their Eddie, their living logo, you know. It was supposed to be this big deal and then, yeah, it sank without a trace.
Jason, Eddie is the Iron Maiden mascot.
I haven't even been listening.
Islands in the stream. That is what we are. No one in between. How can we be wrong? Sail away with me to another world. And we rely on each other. From one lover to another.
Jason and Jeff's theme song. Islands in the Stream.
Islands in
that
the
is
Stream.
Where we are.
Kenny Rogers, Dolly Parton.
No one in between, except for Lifton's mom. Now, when I was a kid and I heard this song, I just had no idea that it was a Bee Gees song. I probably didn't know that until probably I started working on Chart Attack or started writing about music.
Yeah, but it's one of those things that once you know it.
Once you know it, you can't unknow it. Like, it's like, oh, God, yes, of course.
I didn't think I knew it until, I guess they did, was it like an A&E show? Mm-hmm. I think it was. And they did it there.
Along with Heartbreaker, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was one of those songs that they kind of reclaimed in the late 90s.
Yeah. It was during that very smart period for the Bee Gees.
Yeah.
Where Barry Gibb just thought, you know what? Nobody likes me right now. I'm just going to sit back and still do what I do, but not put my name on it.
Has anybody ever done that successfully before?
I don't know.
I mean, that takes, like, those guys, they have to have healthy egos. But it takes a lot of self-awareness to say, I'm going to go behind the scenes now.
Yeah. Very smart. Barry Gibb was always very smart. But
what I love, and I did not know until yesterday, was that this song was originally written for Marvin Gaye.
It's crazy, right?
Imagine him singing it.
I love this song so much.
It is. You can't hear it and not smile.
It's a good song. Well, you probably could listen to it and not smile if you were in South Bend, Indiana in 2008. I just read on here there was a radio station that when they were stunting before a format change, they played the song nonstop for several days.
3 days, yeah.
That's funny.
We keep going back to this whole thing about the way this era was and the different types of music that had a home on the charts. I would like to point out that this song topped the Hot AC chart, the Hot 100, and the country charts.
Oh, yeah.
I think all of us at the time were young enough that we probably thought that Kenny and Dolly were just sort of always a duo.
And that they were, like, married or something.
This was the first thing they did, though.
No, not for me.
Wasn't it?
It was I think it was the first thing they did, but I always knew them as separate entities. Here's where I want to make up for my mistake with
Are you bringing Kenny and Dolly onto the show?
Yes, I am.
He's about to pick up his guitar.
No, the Brian in his book has a great segment in his book of rock trivia, called "So Was They Boning or Was They Not Boning?"
Popular duet partners.
Right, and whether or not they were boning or not.
Boning or not boning.
And it leads off with Islands in the Stream. So I want to read what he says here to kind of make up for messing up and ruining his chance at getting plugged here. So this is a plug for Brian's book. Despite these two being more inseparable in the 80s than Ronald Reagan and his doting mother Nancy, and the fact that most children at the time thought that they were married, at least I did, no boning here. Parton has been with her rarely seen husband Carl Dean since 1966, Rogers has had five wives. None of them were Dolly, a fact that likely haunts him as he lies awake each night, weeping face down on a pair of gigantic pillows as he screams, "You're the coward of the county, Kenny Rogers. You are, for letting her get away." So, everybody, buy Brian Boone's book. I love rock and roll, except when I hate it. Extremely important stuff about the songs and bands you love, hate, love to hate, and hate to love.
Amazing book.
Yes.
Amazing book. And I should mention, if you're looking for Christmas gifts, it's thin, so it fits really great into a stocking.
It's frustratingly short.
And we'll have a link to it in the show notes.
It needs it definitely needs a sequel, which we hope Brian is working on. So Islands of the Stream says here, it wasn't a duet in the original.
No. Yeah, I read that too. They recorded it and Kenny wasn't happy.
Bring in the big guns.
Bring in the big guns, yep. So this shows you, like, originally it was written as an R&B song. And then they changed it to make it a country song for Kenny. Right. And then they changed it again to make it a duet.
Right.
That's, I mean, hooray for craftsmanship, right?
Yeah.
Sure.
Not that I've never really loved this song, but hooray for craftsmanship.
Uptown Girl.
Yeah. Hi, Dad. Uptown Girl. Why do you hate it?
Because it's dumb. And because it was overplayed. I don't know. I didn't like any of the hits from this record, really, except for Leave a Tender Moment Alone.
I didn't know Billy Joel until this album, really. Like, I didn't know Billy Joel until this album. Like, this is, you know, because, again, MTV.
Right.
And it was after this album that I went back and listened to The Stranger. And then I was like, whoa.
So, you know, it's funny. Like, I don't think Innocent Man is... I don't think it... It doesn't seem like it would be the best gateway album to the rest of Billy Joel's stuff.
Yeah, I can understand that. I think I had a cousin... Well, I mean, I know I had a cousin. I had a cousin who had The Stranger and made me a copy after I had been listening to my cassette of Innocent Man.
And it didn't sound like Frankie Valli.
The Stranger didn't.
Yeah.
I think this is a great album.
I do, too.
I like Innocent Man for a few reasons. One, because if you look at the history of Billy Joel, he's generally been a sour person.
Sure.
Yeah.
And this is like the one album where, like if you care about Billy Joel, this is the one album where he actually sounds legitimately overjoyed to be alive.
Well, wouldn't you be?
Yeah, seriously.
That's why Jeff doesn't like this. He likes his Billy Joel miserable.
No, it's just hokey. It's just cheese. It's
kind of hokey, but you know.
Tell her about it in Uptown Girl. I don't know. When this record came out, I had already been a fan of Billy's for at least a year or two. And, you know, most of my friends were listening to Michael Jackson and well, I don't know, this was 83, so maybe Cyndi Lauper. You know, the popular bands. And, you know, I didn't even know that Billy was a popular artist. I didn't realize he'd had platinum albums. Like, to my age group, he was a nobody.
Right.
And so for him to finally, in the context of my age group, for him to finally hit it big.
Be accepted.
And do it with stuff like Uptown Girl and tell her about it. It just kind of left a sour aftertaste. But I kind of think that I look at this record like his Graceland, where he was taking another form of music and using it to kind of jumpstart his creative process.
But I think he did a good job with it. I mean, I think the production of this song, I mean, it all sounds, you know, Four Seasons-y.
And I think it's great because I got no problem with the Four Seasons. And it's a perfect pastiche of the Four Seasons. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And the chords are actually quite pretty, especially in the little bridge section, are really, really inventive and smart. And when you play this song, if you play this song on piano, you know, I've seen videos where Billy Joel talks about the genesis of this song and kind of plays it as if it were a classical song.
Right.
And it, like just on piano, it sounds like this pretty little lullaby.
It opens in E, and then for the second section, and when she's walking, it goes drops down to C, and then does four bars for eight bars, and then it does four bars in A.
Right.
To get back to the E. And the OO section that is in G.
Yeah.
You know, we've talked about David Foster's key changes.
Right. I thought you were going to go there with this.
But all those do is, the David Foster key change is draw attention to Foster's compositional skills.
But the thing about this song is that I don't think any of those key changes are really discernible.
Exactly. No. That's it.
And that's what Dave is saying, that it's seamless.
And yeah, that's very much what Bob Gaudio is doing on those Four Seasons songs. And
yeah.
As much as a lot of people, because a lot of people use this song as an example of why they hate Billy Joel. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of that was largely because of the video.
And it was overplayed, too.
Right. And the fact that they have to wheel him on the cart in that scene. In
this video. I like this video. Again, I like it because, especially looking back now, because everything in Billy Joel's life is just so cynical and bitter that it's like, it surprises me that he would allow himself to write this song.
And star in the video.
And star in the video and dance in the video.
Right.
Yeah.
He fucking dances.
It's the power of love.
No, that's Huey Lewis.
Thank you.
Seems like a good time to hit number two.
Yep, and Ted, you can start listening again.
say what you want.
For our number two song, Say, Mac and Jack.
Did I say that Uptown Girl was stupid? I'd like to take that back.
I don't know. This is another one I think that the video... I think this is another one where the video kind of killed it.
Oh, the video's awful.
Oh, I like the video.
I would say that at certain points in the 80s, Paul McCartney was like Will I Am. Like, nobody was better at being dumb than McCartney.
I love
and you. This is an example of how successful he was at being utterly vapid and inane.
It's definitely a stupid song, but I like it.
Yeah. Which song would you throw off a bridge first? This one or The Girl Is Mine?
The Girl Is Mine.
Okay. So when I was younger, I would have said I would have thrown The Girl Is Mine off first. But now I think I would say Say.
Why?
Because I think now I like The Girl Is Mine better.
Why?
I don't know.
All right.
Just like, I like the beat of it.
The Girl Is Mine is the one with the spoken word, right?
Yeah.
Yes, I'm a lover, not a fighter.
Oh, God. He's a lover, not a fighter until he gets a hold of the potion, the strength potion in this shitty fucking video.
So this song, so Say doesn't, it doesn't have a chorus, does it?
No, it's just three sections.
Right.
Oh, I didn't notice that before.
Whatever section is the, all alone, I sit on by the phone.
That's the second section, yeah.
Love that.
That's great, yeah.
Love that.
And the way that he comes in that part with the guitar underneath, Just like giving like a little bit of funk guitar in there.
Yep.
That's fantastic.
Yep. Compositionally, it's pretty bright, but
yeah,
everything else about it is so stupid.
No, I think it's a great song.
I do think that the bridge, the way that the You Never Ever Worry, you know, I think that doesn't fit in with the rest of the song. And and that kind of transition, the it doesn't fit in properly with the rest of the song.
Do you think didn't George Martin produce this?
Yeah.
So do you think that was him, his influence? You know, the his old trick of sewing stuff together out of thin air?
Oh, no, I just mean that from a compositional standpoint. Mm-hmm. Not a production thing. I just think that the...
No, but that's what I mean. Like, do you think he was there saying, Paul, what if you...
I think by this point, in his relationship with McCartney, his job was just to roll tape.
I was going to say something similar.
I think he could, if McCartney asked, would provide an opinion. But he, mm-hmm. I think he was largely just staying out of the way. Because it was always a good angle to say, hey, it's a Paul McCartney album produced by George Martin. And Jeff mm-hmm. Emmerich also engineered it.
Something else interesting about the song is that the song is in a minor key, but like you'd never think of that.
No,
that was one of the things that I realized when I was listening to it last night. The don't play games with my affection. You know, like I mm-hmm. guess it's like an A minor to D minor.
That's what adds that little bit of tension.
Yeah, just like a little bit of a blues lick in there. You know,
we occasionally do this song when our friend Warren comes by. We occasionally do this song in acoustic 80s, and just have a ball. It's a fun song to do.
Yeah.
You know, especially because we actually pause and go, beep.
Can we point out here? Can we stop to point out the? I want to go back to this arm wrestling thing, the strength potion. Mm-hmm. Can we just point out the number of things that we as a pop audience were willing to ignore?
That the Old West was desegregated.
Well, no, no.
But that's what struck me.
But no, like, did anybody ever give a second thought watching Michael Jackson beat somebody in arm wrestling?
No, of course, but that was the whole idea.
But it's kind of like, do you think so?
Well, I mean, the whole idea was that they were scamming people.
Yeah.
You know, that wasn't a problem. I mean, that was the idea, that you take the 98-pound weakling and...
This is a fun
But he
video.
Did, though, try to project an aura of toughness. And I kind of... It made me think of, like, George Michael and Liberace and Rock Hudson and you know, the stuff that...
Freddie Mercury.
Freddie Mercury, exactly.
Why are you putting George Michael in this category? George Michael doesn't belong in that category. Wait. I don't even think you explain what the category is. Go ahead. Sorry. Continue. I'm already taking offense, but go ahead.
Well, the other thing that we ignored was the fact that the girl that Michael Jackson woos in the video is LaToya.
It's LaToya. Oh, come on.
Again, Michael probably just didn't want to ask anybody else to do the role. Ola Ray should be honored.
Yeah.
That she was one of the, like, two girls in Michael. Actually, well, there's probably more spoke than that. Spoke to. Now, right. There's the girl in... The Way You Make Me Feel, who nobody knows her name, and what's her name? Naomi Campbell.
Right.
And don't forget Brooke Shields. Video.
She wasn't in the video.
She should have been in this one.
I think this video is fun. After we're done today, I'm going to go watch this video.
It is a fun video, but it's deeply stupid.
The thing that I always think of when I think of this video is a few years ago, on the Tony Awards, they did they had Carol Channing and LL Cool J presenting.
What?
Yeah, they presented. And they did like a really stupid little thing version of Hello Dolly there, and Lewis Black about it on the Daily Show the next week said, "I haven't seen a case against integration like this since the video for Say Say Say."
LL Cool J doing Hello Dolly?
And then the shot over that, over Lewis Black saying that, was the thing with the bit with the shaving cream in the Say 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 movie. So I can't hear a Say 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 without thinking of that funny line.
Yeah.
And you know it's even worse. The B-side for this song, the B-side of this single.
Oh, To a Koala Bear.
That's right. I found that out while working on the Michael Jackson book.
Ode to a Koala Bear.
Yeah. But the other thing that I learned was that this was, when they were recording the sessions, when they were doing the sessions for the song, this is when McCartney suggested that Jackson get into publishing.
Yeah, I saw that on Wikipedia.
Yeah. We all do our research in the same place.
Michael spending the night at the McCartney's house.
Yeah.
That's right. And that's the representation of boom.
Everybody sing, everybody dance. Lose yourself in wild romance. We're going to party, caramba, fiesta, forever. Come on and sing along. We're going to party, caramba, fiesta, forever. Come on and sing along.
Number one song for the week of November 26, 1983. All Night Long, All Night by Lionel Richie.
Song fucking lasts all night long.
Or as most of the adults in my neighborhood called him, that nice black man Lionel Richie.
The black man everyone can agree on at work.
Right. And guys, if I had one word to describe this song, it would be outrageous!
Ugh. It's too long. That's how to describe it.
That's true. The album version is over 6 minutes long.
Yeah.
But they edited it down to like 4 minutes or so in the like the radio version.
No, this song needs to be 3:05.
Love this song. Love this song. I do this in we do this in acoustic 80s. Jeff, I'm sure you've heard us do this song.
Probably.
This is he's like, I was drunk.
usually when I see acoustic 80s.
The number reason why I like this song. One, Richard Marx sings backing vocal.
I was going to ask you if he's on that stupid Jumbo Jumbo breakdown.
I'm not sure if he's on that part. I know he's on. I'm certain he's on the All Night, All Night. Did you see who? I'm sure you guys all saw who did the video.
Michael Nesmith.
Huh. Michael Nesmith. Yeah. Never would have guessed that.
This song, such a good example of our endless love in the 80s for phony exotic flavor.
Yes.
Jesus.
Starting with Sting's fake
reggae. How many Jamaicans do you think wanted to punch Lionel Richie in his fucking face?
Seriously, especially because I'm pretty sure he made it up.
Yeah, I'm sure he did.
Right? Right, I'm pretty sure he made the whole thing up because like there's so many different dialects that like he was just like
we're good.
I'm Lionel Richie.
Jumbo Jumbo.
Jumbo Jumbo.
Yeah, I think that you know it's always easy to, especially us as being critically minded, to knock breezy lightweight danceable pop. But you only need to listen to the Black Eyed Peas to understand just how good this is.
Mm. No, this is a very, very, very solid record.
Yeah, and this is... I like this song.
I do not like this song.
You don't like this song? I do.
Because it's so... there's nothing there.
Big deal.
What's he saying? He's saying all night long. All night. God damn it. Come up with a rhyme.
But Say It Isn't So doesn't have... a rhyme in
you
the chorus.
Shut
either.
Your mouth, Dave Lifton. Don't you say anything bad about Say It Isn't So. I will say...
where's the chorus in Say It Isn't So?
No, I think he has a point here, Jeff.
This song is better than Dancing on the Ceiling. I'll say that much.
I think you need to address Dave's point that he just...
I will not address Dave's point.
Victory!
Yeah, I think Dave... you know how much I hate to give the victory to Dave, but I think he won this. I think he won this because... those lyrics aren't saying... There are lyrics. I don't think they're saying anything either.
It just repeats the title.
But they say they say nothing for a shorter length of time than All Night Long.
Wait. Let me read you this quote about All Night Long. What I try to write about are real events. Let me finish. There will always be an easy like Sunday morning. There will always be an endless love. There will always be an all night long.
What does that even mean?
I don't know. And that's the top 10.
That's the top 10
this week. Good job,
guys. Great top 10. A solid top 10.
I think this was, in terms of quality, the best one we've done. The best songs that we've done. Aruba, Jamaica. And let's move on to the endorsements, where each of us picks something that's been we've been listening to or has been on our mind recently. And because he picked such a great chart, we will start with Jason.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, you know, it's it's now after Thanksgiving, so you're allowed to listen to Christmas music now, if you so desire. And I have to be honest, I have not listened to a lot of new Christmas releases yet because I've been knee-deep in shit. Crappy Christmas music. But I did take the time to listen to Tommy Emmanuel's Christmas album, All I Want for Christmas. And it's quite good. I was tremendously afraid that there was going to be like some sensitive vocal on it, which is like kryptonite for Tommy Emmanuel.
I love that now when you see that one of your favorite artists is going to release a Christmas record, your first response is fear.
Yeah, it's totally true. Well, also you have to look at the cover of this album. And know that, like, if you look at the cover of this album, you go, oh, this is not going to be good. This is going to be quite bad.
Yeah, he looks like he's about 6 feet away from a reindeer sweater.
Yes, yes. And, like, clearly the photo was taken in July, and they had nothing else to do, so they put him in a red shirt and held him up with a Christmas mug. It's like he was posing for a Melamus photo. I mean, really. You know, there's a bunch of really, really, I mean, it's not, I wouldn't say it's essential, but there are a lot of nice instrumental guitar arrangements of songs, including, I guarantee you've not heard a version of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer as clever as this one that changes keys as many times as this one does. So that's the song that you'll hear.
Did David Foster produce it?
No, Billy Joel did.
Okay.
I think you just threw down a challenge for Gary Hoey.
I like a lot of Gary Hoey's Christmas music.
Yeah.
He's released, what, 3 of those albums?
All 18 volumes of Ho,
All 18
Ho,
volumes? Well, I feel like if you've got a name like Gary Hoey, you kind of have to do that.
Yeah.
You know? But that's neither here nor there. So Tommy Emmanuel's Christmas record is my way of saying I don't really have another endorsement for this month. Okay, Jeff, what's your endorsement this month?
You guys, I think, saw me send out a picture of this when it arrived at my house the other day. I'm going to endorse the Looney Tunes Platinum Collection Volume 1.
Excellent.
Three discs of Looney Tunes on Blu-ray, and it's awesome. My kids spent hours cracking up at this stuff yesterday.
That must have made you so happy.
It did make me so happy. These were my favorite cartoons when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And they had never seen any of them before. They had no idea who the Tasmanian Devil was, or Marvin the Martian, or Pepe Le Pew, or any of that stuff. And they thought it was hysterical.
What the shit is that?
Well, the only Looney Tunes you can get on television these days are what's the name of the new Bugs Bunny Daffy Duck show on Cartoon Network? Do you know what I'm talking about?
No.
Nope. No, I'm an adult.
Well, I think it's geared towards adults, but I haven't watched it. It's a new, Cartoon Network just brought Bugs and Daffy back, but they don't look like they used to look, and it just bothers me. I want this stuff. I want the old stuff. So I was really excited to get it, and I got this, I foolishly bought the limited edition collector's item version that comes in a big box with a shot glass and a commemorative cell.
You bought this?
I did.
Wow.
I have number 1,189 of 36,000.
Congratulations.
Yeah, I can't wait for volume 2. I love this.
Kill the wabbit, kill the wabbit, kill the wabbit.
Kill the wabbit.
Yo-ho-to, 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 yo-ho.
Almighty warrior of great fighting stock, might I inquire to ask him, what's up, Doc?
I'm going to kill the wabbit.
Almighty hunter, twill be quite a task. How will you do it, might I inquire to ask?
I will do it with my spear and magic helmet.
Your spear and magic helmet?
Spear and magic helmet.
Magic helmet.
Magic helmet.
Magic helmet.
And Dave, what are you endorsing this month?
I'm going to endorse All Because of You by Lisa Welchel.
You All right. have to have something better than that.
Oh, yeah.
To endorse.
I think you know what I'm endorsing, Jeff.
Do I?
Because I heard about it from you about 6 weeks ago. Jeff.
Oh, yeah.
Interviewed a singer-songwriter by the name of Julian Villard, who had released an album called Mr. Saturday Night.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and I read that, and just based on what he was saying, I said, I got to hear this. And I bought the album, I fell in love with it, and that coincided with a performance that he did here. And so I went to see that, and it was one of the most entertaining shows I've ever seen. And I wrote a review that's also up at Poptose. He's kind of a cross between the four piano men of the 70s. There's a little bit of Randy Newman, some Billy Joel, some Tom Waits, some Elton John. And he kind of performs as this character called Mr. Saturday Night that's kind of an extension of him, which is, I think, kind of where the where I see the Tom Waits. It's really not into songwriting, but the idea of this character who's kind of a highly stylized version of himself. And he's a self-described agoraphobic New York Jewish singer-songwriter, and we're supposed to believe that in the club where he's playing, he is broadcasting from his 250-square-foot Brooklyn studio apartment, and he's streaming it over the internet, and we are watching it on our screens at home. And it's a whole presentation that involves digital samples and cardboard cutouts of Michael Jackson and Hall & Oates. That's just a very different way of putting across these very good songs that is for 75 minutes will just have you smiling the whole time. It's just really good songs and put over in a very innovative and fun way.
I like this album a lot. I've given it a lot of listens on Spotify. These songs, you obviously knew they were good. Like when you wake up in the middle of the night and these songs are in your head, you know it's a good album.
Yeah.
And a lot of these songs were in my head. Onto Something specifically is a song I really like.
Yeah, it's a good song.
Got this great little bridge in it. Great chords, great strings behind it.
The Guy Who is one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That could have been a hit any era. Yeah.
That's great. Love Again for the First Time is great. This album is good. I've played this after hours at work, like you know, when there aren't a lot of people in the office, and we're on the phone all day, so I can't really play music out loud. But, you know, after hours, I've played the song, and multiple people have come over and been like, who is that? That's really good. So I missed his last New York show. I'm hoping to see him soon.
It's one of my favorite records of the year. It's been really gratifying to see you guys and some other people that we know respond to it.
Yeah, because it goes back to, like, you know, the thing that I, as you guys know, that is most important for me, just the type of song that has just a really strong melody and interesting chord changes and
smart production too.
Yeah, that is.
Yeah, sure.
It's not cluttered at all. There's a lot of things in there, but there's a lot of space.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the horns, but there's a good separation on the horns, and because it's not compressed within an inch of its life.
No, it sounds very warm, and there's a lot of room in the arrangements, even though there's a lot going on. It's very smartly arranged.
Yeah.
He's a craftsman. He knows what he's doing.
Exactly.
And I, like you told him the other day, after you guys met up, it's just too bad that he wasn't signed in 81.
So yeah, Julian Villard, Mr. Saturday Night, and go and see him whenever he performs.
Go buy it, people. Yep. You will not regret it. And you can listen to it while you're reading Brian Boone's book.
Working out, getting fit, pretty soon I'm gonna quit. Smoking's bad for my AIM. Got a car, got some clothes, DVDs from HBO. All I need for my sale. What's gonna happen when it feels like love again for the first time, for the first time? I make my way back down the long line, such a long line. And it feels like love again for the first time, for the first time in a while.
Okay, and that's going to do it for this episode of the Pop Dose Podcast. I hope you all had a good Thanksgiving. As always, go to popdose.com for all the latest in pop culture discussion. And remember, December 1st is the beginning of Melamus. I've been very good. I've seen that the first of those posts are up there and ready to go, but I haven't clipped
it. I have a bunch more that I need to put in there. I think we've done 14.
Wow. Already. But I haven't. I haven't clicked on them no matter how much I've been tempted. I've looked at a couple of the tags, but that's about it.
I just realized the other day that I need to write the first one.
That's
day
right.
One is always a little bit of a recap.
And, right.
Jason has sort of fucked off for this year. Left me with the writing and the formatting, so I need to write
In my defense, I did it all the past 2 years.
That's true. You did.
I did absolutely all the formatting. So this year I said I can't do it. But I've been available for chatting. And
yes.
I've listened to all the shit you said. And I don't want to say anything, but the last day has already been. We think
amazing.
Unless something comes around to top it, which I doubt it will.
Yeah.
The last day has already been written.
Wow,
it's pretty unbelievable.
So we'll leave you with that.
All right. So as always, follow us on Twitter at PopDose. Join our Facebook group and download all of our back episodes on iTunes. And hopefully, we'll be back with another episode next month.
Fingers crossed.
Yep. Jason, Jeff, what should we talk about?
I have no fucking idea, Dave. I just don't know what we're going to talk about next month. I think we should just let it breathe.
Did you take
like
acting
Kenny
lessons?
Loggins, like Kenny Loggins says, let it breathe. Let the music breathe. Let the podcast breathe, Dave Lifton.
You're doing your Jerry Seinfeld fake outrage thing very well.
I have a feeling we'll probably talk a lot about Christmas music.
Oh, next episode. You think?
I think, maybe. Depending on when it's recorded, yes.
Right. Well... anybody has any topics, please.
Save us from talking about Melamus.
Right, exactly.
Well, have a good have a good month, everybody.
I will not have a good month. Thank you very much, Dave Lifton. And I would appreciate you not telling me what to do.
I wasn't talking to you. I was talking to our audience. I was addressing our audience in the outro.
I am speaking for our audience. I think they would also appreciate you not telling them what to do. Have a good month. What if they don't want to have a good month?
I think that you shouldn't be so presumptuous as to think that you speak for the entire audience.
Well, you shouldn't be so presumptuous to tell them
what
to do.
I'm just going to sneak out here.
Bye, everybody.
Jason, I can't wait until you're a father. You're going to be great.
Oh, I think so, too. Yeah. Shame we never got the Charlotte Ray disco album.
We came close with Ethel Merman.
Well, that's what I was thinking of. Yeah. I guess in my mind they kind of look the same.
Yeah.
They're not that far apart, right?
I don't think
looks
so.
Looks wise, Charlotte Ray and Ethel Merman.
I think by that point they kind of were.
Here's a conversation I never imagined myself having. Comparing the facial merits. Of the similarities between
Ethel Merman,
Charlotte Ray and Ethel Merman.
Charlotte Ray. Well.
All right, so should we move on? Should we begin?
No, I like the uncomfortable silence.
Okay.